Bigfoot on Campus by Jim Butcher. The campus police officer folded his hands and stared at me from across the table.
Coffee?
What flavor is it? I asked. He was in his 40s, a big solid man with bags under his calm, weary eyes, and his name tag read Dean.
It's coffee-flavored coffee. No mocha?
Fuck mocha.
Thank God, I said. Black?
Officer Dean gave me black hot coffee in a paper cup, and I sipped at it gratefully. I was almost done shivering. It just came in intermittent bursts now. The old wool blanket Dean had given me was more gesture than cure.
Am I under arrest? I asked him.
Officer Dean moved his shoulders in what could have been a shrug.
That's what we're going to talk about.
Uh-huh, I said.
Maybe, he said in a slow rural drawl, you could explain to me why I found you in the middle of an orgy.
Well, I said, if you're going to be in an orgy, the middle is the best spot, isn't it? He made a thoughtful sound.
Maybe you could explain why there was a car on the fourth floor of the dorm.
Classic college prank, I said.
He grunted. Usually when that happens, it hasn't made big holes in the exterior wall.
Someone was avoiding the cliché? I asked. He looked at me for a moment and said,
what about all the blood?
There were no injuries, were there?
No,
he said. Then who cares? Some film student probably watched Carrie too many times. Officer Dean tapped his pencil's eraser on the tabletop. It was the most agitated thing I'd seen him do.
6 separate calls in the past 3 hours with a Bigfoot sighting on campus. Bigfoot. What do you know about that?
Well, kids these days, with their internets and their video games and their iPods, who knows what they thought they saw? Officer Dean put down his pencil. He looked at me and said calmly,
my job is to protect a bunch of kids with access to every means of self-destruction known to man from not only the criminal element, but themselves. I got chemistry students who can make their own meth, ecstasy, and LSD. I got ROTC kids with access to automatic weapons and explosives. I got enough alcohol going through here on a weekly basis to float a battleship. I got a thriving trade in recreational drugs. I got lives to protect.
Sounds tiring.
About to get tired of you, he said. Start giving it to me straight.
Will you arrest me? I asked.
No,
Dean said.
I bounce your face off my knuckles for a while. Then I ask again,
isn't that unprofessional conduct?
Fuck conduct,
Dean said.
I got kids to look after.
I sipped the coffee some more. Now that the shivers had begun to subside, I finally felt the knotted muscles in my belly begin to relax. I slowly settled back into my chair. Dean hadn't blustered or tried to intimidate me in any way. He wasn't trying to scare me into talking. He was just telling me how it was going to be. And he drank his coffee old school. I kind of like the guy. You aren't going to believe me, I said.
I don't much, he said. Try me.
Okay, I said. My name's Harry Dresden. I'm a professional wizard. Officer Dean pursed his lips.
Then he leaned forward slightly and listened. The client wanted me to meet him at a site in the Ouachita Mountains in eastern Oklahoma. Looking at them, you might not realize they were mountains, they're so old. They've had millions of years of wear and tear on them, and they've been ground down to nubs. The site used to be on an Indian reservation, but they don't call them reservations anymore. They're tribal statistical areas now. I showed my letter and my ID to a guy in a pickup who just happened to pull up next to me for a friendly chat at a lonely stop sign on a winding back road. I don't know what the tribe called his office, but I recognized a guardian when I saw one. He read the letter and waved me through in an even friendlier manner than he'd used when he approached me. It's nice to be welcomed somewhere, once in a while. I parked at the spot indicated on the map and hiked a good mile and a half into the hills, taking a heavy backpack with me. I found a pleasant spot to set up camp. The mid-October weather was crisp, but I had a good sleeping bag and would be comfortable as long as it didn't start raining. I dug a fire pit and ringed it in stones, built a modest fire out of fallen limbs, and laid out my sleeping bag on a foam camp pad. By the time it got dark, I was well into preparing the dinner I'd brought with me. The scent of foil-wrapped potatoes baking in coals blended with that of the steaks I had spitted and roasting over the fire. Can I cook a camp meal or what? Bigfoot showed up half an hour after sunset. One minute I was alone. The next, he simply stepped out into view. He was huge. Not huge like a big person, but huge like a horse, with that same sense of raw animal power and mass. He was 9 feet tall at least, and probably tipped the scales at well over 600 pounds. His powerful, wide-shouldered body was covered in long, dark brown hair. Even though he stood in plain sight in my firelight, I could barely see the buckskin bag he'd slung over one shoulder and across his chest. The hair was so long. "Strength of a river in his shoulders," I said. "You're welcome at my fire."
"Wizard Dresden."
River's shoulders rumbled.
"It's good to see you."
He took a couple of long steps and hunkered down opposite the fire from me.
"Man, that smells good."
"Darn right it does," I said. I proceeded with the preparations in companionable silence while River Shoulders stared thoughtfully at the fire. I'd set up my camp this way for a reason. It made me the host and River Shoulders my guest. It meant I was obliged to provide food and drink, and he was obliged to behave with decorum. Guest and host relationships are damned near laws of physics in the supernatural world. They almost never get violated, and when they do, it's a big deal. Both of us felt a lot more comfortable around one another this way. Okay, maybe it did a wee bit more to make me feel comfortable than it did River Shoulders, but he was a repeat customer. I liked him, and I figured he probably didn't get treated to a decent steak all that often. We ate the meal in an almost ritualistic silence, too, other than River making some appreciative noises as he chewed. I popped open a couple of bottles of McAnally's Pale, my favorite brew, by a veritable genius of hops back in Chicago. River liked it so much that he gave me an inquisitive glance when his bottle was empty. So I emptied mine and produced two more. After that, I filled a pipe with expensive tobacco, lit it, took a few puffs, and passed it to him. He nodded and took it. We smoked and finished our beers. By then, the fire had died down to glowing embers.
"Thank you for coming," River Shoulders rumbled. "Again, I come to seek your help on behalf of my son."
"Third time you've come to me," I said.
Yes.
He rummaged in his pouch and produced a small, heavy object. He flicked it to me. I caught it and squinted at it in the dim light. It was a gold nugget about as big as a ping-pong ball. I nodded and tossed it back to him. River Shoulder's brows lowered into a frown. You have to understand, a frown on a mug like his looked indistinguishable from scowling fury. It turned his eyes into shadowed caves with nothing but a faint gleam showing from far back in them. It made his jaw muscles bunch and swell into knots the size of tennis balls on the sides of his face.
You will not help him, the Bigfoot said.
I snorted. You're the one who isn't helping him, big guy.
I am, he said. I'm hiring you.
You're his father, I said quietly. And he doesn't even know your name. He's a good kid. He deserves more than that. He deserves the truth.
He shook his head slowly.
Look at me. Would he even accept my help?
You aren't going to know unless you try it, I said. And I never said I wouldn't help him. At that, River Shoulders frowned a little more. I curbed an instinct to edge away from him.
Then what do you want in exchange for your services?
He asked. I help the kid, I said. You meet the kid. That's the payment. That's the deal.
You do not know what you are asking, he said.
With respect, River Shoulders, this is not a negotiation. If you want my help, I just told you how to get it. He became very still at that. I got the impression that maybe people didn't often use tactics like that when they dealt with him. When he spoke, his voice was a quiet, distant rumble.
You have no right to ask this.
Yeah, I'm a wizard. I meddle. It's what we do.
Manifestly true.
He turned his head slightly away.
You do not know how much you ask.
I know that kid deserves more than you've given him.
I have seen to his protection, to his education. That is what fathers do.
Sure, I said. But you weren't ever there. And that matters. Absolute silence fell for a couple of minutes. Look, I said gently, take it from a guy who knows. Growing up without a dad is terrifying. You're the only father he's ever going to have. You can go hire Superman to look out for Erwin if you want to, and he'd still be the wrong guy because he isn't you. River toyed with the empty bottle, rolling it across his enormous fingers like a regular guy might have done with a pencil. Do you want me on this? I asked him. No hard feelings if you don't. River looked at me again and nodded slowly.
I know that if you agree to help him, you will do so. I will pay your price.
Okay, I said. Tell me about Erwin's problem.
What'd he say?
Officer Dean asked. He said the kid was at the University of Oklahoma for school, I said. River had had a bad dream and knew that the kid's life was in danger.
The cop grunted.
So, Bigfoot's a psychic?
Think about it. No one ever gets a good picture of one, much less a clean shot, I said. Despite all the expeditions and TV shows and whatnot, River's people have got more going for them than being huge and strong. My guess is that they're smarter than humans. Maybe a lot smarter. My guess is they know magic of some kind, too.
Jesus, Officer Dean said. You really believe all this, don't you?
I want to believe, I said. And I told you that you wouldn't.
Dean grunted. Then he said, Usually they're too drunk to make sense when I get a story like this. Keep going.
I got to Norman, Oklahoma, a bit before noon the next morning. It was a Wednesday, which was a blessing. In the Midwest, if you show up to a college town on a weekend, you risk running into a football game. In my experience, that resulted in universal problems with traffic, available hotel rooms, and drunken football hooligans. Or wait, soccer is the one with hooligans. Drunken American football fans are just drunks, I guess. River had provided me with a small dossier he'd had prepared, which included a copy of his kid's class schedule. I parked my car in an open spot on the street not too far from campus and ambled on over. I got some looks. I sort of stand out in a crowd. I'm a lot closer to 7 feet tall than six, which might be one reason why River Shoulders like to hire me. I look a lot less tiny than other humans, to him. Add in the big black leather duster and the scar on my face, and I looked like the kind of guy you'd want to avoid in dark alleys. The university campus was as confusing as all of them are, with buildings that had constantly evolved into and out of multiple roles over the years. They were all named after people I doubt any of the students had ever heard of or cared about, and there seemed to be no organizational logic at all at work there. It was a pretty enough campus, I supposed. Lots of red brick and brownstone buildings. Lots of architectural doohickeys on many of the buildings in a kind of quasi-classical Greek style. The ivy that was growing up many of the walls seemed a little too cultivated and obvious for my taste. Then again, I had exactly the same amount of regard for the Ivy League as I did for the Big 12. The grass was an odd color, like maybe someone had sprayed it with a blue-green dye or something, though I had no idea what kind of delusional creep would do something so pointless. And of course, there were students. A whole lot of kids, all of them with things to do and places to be. I could have wandered around all day, but I thought I'd save myself the headache of attempting to apply logic to a university campus and stopped a few times to ask for directions. Irwin Pounder, River Shoulder's son, had a physics course at noon, so I picked up a notebook and a couple of pens at the university bookstore and ambled on into the large classroom. It was a perfect disguise. The notebook was college-ruled. I sat near the back, where I could see both doors into the room, and waited. Bigfoot Irwin was going to stand out in the crowd almost as badly as I did. The kid was huge. River had shown me a photo that he kept in his medicine bag, carefully laminated to protect it from the elements. Irwin's mom could have been a second-string linebacker for the Bears. Carol Pounder was a formidable woman, and over 6 feet tall. But her boy was a head taller than she already, and still had the awkward, too lean look of someone who wasn't finished growing. His shoulders had come in, though, and it looked like he might have had to turn sideways to walk through doors. I waited and waited, watching both doors, until the professor arrived and the class started. Irwin never arrived. I was going to leave, but it actually turned out to be kind of interesting. The professor was a lunatic, but a really entertaining one. The guy drank liquid nitrogen right there in front of everybody and blew it out his nose in this huge jet of vapor. I applauded along with everyone else, and before I knew it, the lecture was over. I might even have learned something. Okay. Maybe there were some redeeming qualities to a college education. I went to Irwin's next class, which was a freshman biology course in another huge classroom. No Irwin. He wasn't at his 4 o'clock math class either, and I emerged from it bored and cranky. None of Irwin's other teachers held a candle to Dr. Indestructo. Huh. Time for Plan B. River's dossier said that Irwin was playing football for OU. He'd made the team as a walk-on, and River had been as proud as any father would be about the athletic prowess of his son. So I ambled on over to the Sooners' practice field, where the team was warming up with a run. Even among the football players, Irwin stood out. He was half a head taller than any of them, at least my own height. He looked gangly and thin beside the fellows around him, even with the shoulder pads on. But I recognized his face. I'd last seen him when he was about 14. Though his rather homely features had changed a bit, they seemed stronger and more defined. There was no mistaking his dark, intelligent eyes. I stuck my hands in the pockets of my old leather duster and waited, watching the field. I'd found the kid, and absent any particular danger, I was in no particular hurry. There was no sense in charging into the middle of Irwin's football practice and his life and disrupting everything. I'm just not that kind of guy. Okay, well, I try not to be. Seems to keep happening, though, doesn't it? I said to myself, you show up on somebody's radar and things go to DEFCON 1 a few minutes later.
I'm sorry,
said a young woman's voice.
Ah, said Officer Dean. This is where the girl comes in.
Who said there was a girl?
There's always a girl.
Well, I said, yes and no. She was blonde, about 5'6", and my logical mind told me that every inch of her was a bad idea. The rest of me, especially my hindbrain, suggested that she would be an ideal mate, preferably sooner rather than later. There was nothing in particular about her that should have caused my hormones to rage. I mean, she was young and fit, and she had the body of the young and fit, and that's hardly ever unpleasant to look at. She had eyes the color of cornflowers and rosy cheeks, and she was a couple of notches above cute when it came to her face. She was wearing running shorts, and her legs were smooth and generally excellent. Some women just have it. And no, I can't tell you what it means because I don't get it myself. It was something mindless, something chemical. And even as my metaphorically burned fingers were telling me to walk away, the rest of me was going through that male physiological response the science guys in the Netherlands have documented recently. Not that one. Well, maybe a little. I'm talking about the response where when a pretty girl is around, it hits the male brain like a drug and temporarily impairs his cognitive function, literally dropping the male IQ. And hey, how Freudian is it that the study was conducted in the Netherlands? This girl dropped that IQ nuke on my brain, and I was standing there staring a second later while she smiled uncertainly at me. Sorry? I asked. My mind was in the Netherlands. Her dimple deepened and her eyes sparkled. She knew all about the brain nuke.
I just said that you sounded like a dangerous guy.
She winked at me. It was adorable.
I like those.
You're into bad boys, huh?
Maybe.
She said, lowering her voice and drawing the word out a little as if it was a confession. She spoke with a very faint drawl.
Plus, I like meeting new people from all kinds of places, and you don't exactly strike me as a local, darling.
You dig dangerous guys who are just passing through, I said.
Do you ever watch those cop shows on TV?
She tilted back her head and laughed.
Most boys don't give me lip like that in the first few minutes of conversation.
I'm not a boy, I said.
She gave me a once-over with those pretty eyes, taking a heartbeat longer about it than she really needed.
No, she said. No, you are not.
My inner non-moron kept on stubbornly ringing alarm bells, and the rest of me slowly became aware of them. My glance thought that I'd better keep playing along. It was the only way to find out what the girl might have been interested in, right?
Right.
I was absolutely not continuing the conversation because I'd gone soft in the head.
I hope that's not a problem, I said. I just don't see how it could be. I'm Connie.
Harry.
So what brings you to Norman, Harry?
Taking a look at a player, I said. Her eyes brightened.
Ooh, you're a scout.
Maybe, I said in the same tone she'd used earlier. Connie laughed again.
I'll bet you talk to silly college girls like me all the time.
Like you? I replied. No, not so much. Her eyes sparkled again.
You may have found my weakness. I'm the kind of girl who likes a little flattery.
And here I was thinking you like something completely different. She covered her mouth with one hand and her cheeks got a little pinker.
Harry, that's not how one talks to young ladies in the South.
Obviously. I mean, you look so outraged. Should I apologize?
Oh, she said, her smile widening. I just have to collect you.
Connie's eyes sparkled again.
And I finally got it.
Her eyes weren't twinkling. They were becoming increasingly flecked with motes of molten silver. Cutie Pie was a friggin' vampire. I've worked for years on my poker face. Years. It still sucks pretty bad, but I've been working on it, so I'm sure my smile was only slightly wooden when I asked, "Collect me?" I might not have been hiding my realization very well, but either Connie was better at poker than me, or else she really was too absorbed in the conversation to notice.
"Collect you," she said. "When I meet someone worthwhile, I like to have dinner with them. And we'll talk and tell stories and laugh, and I'll get a picture and put it in my memory book."
I said, "Maybe you're a little young for me." She threw back her head and gave a full-throated laugh.
"Oh, Harry, I'm talking about sharing a meal. That's all, honestly. I know I'm a terrible flirt, but I didn't think you were taking me seriously."
I watched her closely as she spoke, searching for the predatory calculation that I knew had to be in there. Vampires of the White Court.
"Wait," Dean said. "Vampires of the White Castle?"
I sighed. "White Court," Dean grunted.
"Why not just call her a vampire?"
"They come in a lot of flavors," I said.
"And this one was vanilla?"
"There's no such thing as..." I rubbed at the bridge of my nose. "Yes."
Dean nodded. "So why not just call them vanilla vampires?"
"I'll bring it up at the next wizard meeting," I said.
"So the vampires where all the blood came from?"
"No," I sighed. "This kind doesn't feed on blood."
"No? What do they eat then?"
"Life energy."
"Huh?"
I sighed again. "Sex.
Finally, the story gets good. So they eat sex?
Life energy, I repeated. The sex is just how they get started.
Like sticking fangs into your neck, Dean said. Only instead of fangs, I guess they use...
Look, do you want the story or not?
Dean leaned back in his chair and propped his feet up on his desk. You kidding? This is the best one in years.
Anyway, I watched Connie closely, but I saw no evidence of anything in her that I knew had to be there. Vampires are predators who hunt the most dangerous game on the planet. They generally aren't shy about it either. They don't really need to be. If a white court vampire wants to feed off a human, all she really has to do is crook her finger and he comes running. There isn't any ominous music. Nobody sparkles. As far as anyone looking on is concerned, a girl winks at a boy and goes off somewhere to make out. Happens every day. They don't get all coy asking you out to dinner, and they sure as hell don't have pictures in a memory book. This was weird. And long experience has taught me that when the unexplained is bouncing around right in front of you, the smart thing is to back off and figure out what the hell is going on. In my line of work, what you don't know can kill you. But I didn't get the chance. There was a sharp whistle from a coach somewhere on the field, and football players came rumbling off it. One of them came loping toward us, put a hand on top of the 6-foot chain link fence, and vaulted it in one easy motion. Bigfoot Irwin landed lightly, grinning, and continued directly toward Connie. She let out a girlish squeal of delight and pounced on him. He caught her. She wrapped her legs around his hips, held his face in her hands, and kissed him thoroughly. They came up for air a moment later.
Irwin, she said, I met someone interesting. Can I collect him?
The kid only had eyes for Connie. Not that I could blame him, really. His voice was a basso rumble, startlingly like River Shoulders.
I'm always in favor of dinner at the brewery.
She dismounted and beamed at him.
Good. Irwin, this is...
The kid finally looked up at me and blinked.
Harry.
Hey, Irwin, I said. How are things?
Connie looked back and forth between us.
You know each other?
He's a friend, Irwin said.
Dinner, Connie declared. Harry, say you'll share a meal with me.
Interesting choice of words, all things considered.
I think I had an idea what had caused River's bad dream. If a vampire had attached herself to Irwin, the kid was in trouble. Given the addictive nature of Connie's attentions and the degree of control it could give her over Irwin, maybe he wasn't the only one who could be in trouble. My, how little Irwin had grown. I wondered exactly how much of his father's supernatural strength he'd inherited. He looked like he could break me in half without causing a blip in his heart rate. He and Connie looked at me with hopeful smiles, and I suddenly felt like maybe I was the crazy one. Expressions like that should not inspire worry. But every instinct I had told me that something wasn't right. My smile probably got even more wooden.
Sure, I said. Why not?
The brewery was a lot like every other sports bar you'd find in college towns, with the possible exception that it actually was a brewery. Small and medium-sized tanks stood here and there throughout the place, with signs on each describing the kind of beer that was underway. Apparently the beer sampler was traditional. I made polite noises when I tried each, but they were
unexceptional. Okay, granted, I was probably spoiled by having Max Brew available back at home. It wasn't the brewery's fault that their brews were merely excellent. Max's stuff was epic. It was legend. Tough to measure up to that. I kept one hand under the table near a number of tools I thought I might need, all the way through the meal, and waited for the other shoe to drop. Only it never did. Connie and Erwin chattered away like any young couple, snuggled up to one another on adjacent chairs. The girl was charming, funny, and a playful flirt, but Erwin didn't seem discomfited by it. I kept my responses restrained anyway. I didn't want to find out a couple of seconds too late that the seemingly innocent banter was how Connie got her psychic hooks into me. But a couple of hours went by and nothing. Erwin's never told me anything about his father, Connie said.
I don't know much, Erwin said. He's kept his distance over the years. I've looked for him a couple of times, but I never wanted to push him.
How mysterious, Connie said.
I nodded.
For someone like him, I think the word eccentric might apply better.
He's rich? Connie asked.
I feel comfortable saying that money isn't one of his concerns, I said.
I knew it, Connie said and looked slyly at Erwin. There had to be a reason. I'm only into you for your money.
Instead of answering, Erwin calmly picked Connie up out of her chair, using just the muscles of his shoulders and arms, and deposited her on his lap.
Sure you are.
Connie made a little groaning sound and bit her lower lip.
God. I know it's not PC, but I've got to say, I am into it when you get all caveman on me, Pounder.
I know.
Erwin kissed the tip of her nose and turned to me.
So, Harry, what brings you to Norman?
I was passing through, I said easily. Your dad asked me to look in on you.
Just casually,
Erwin said, his dark eyes probing. Because he's such a casual guy.
Something like that, I said. Not that I mind seeing you, Erwin said.
But in case you missed it, I'm all grown up now. I don't need a babysitter. Even a cool, expensive one.
If you did, my rates are very reasonable, Connie said.
We'll talk,
Erwin replied, sliding his arms around her waist. The girl wasn't exactly a junior petite, but she looked tiny on Erwin's scale. She hopped up and said,
I'm going to go make sure there isn't barbecue sauce on my nose, and then we can take the picture. Okay?
Sure,
Erwin said, smiling.
Go.
Once she was gone from sight, Erwin looked at me and dropped his smile.
Okay,
he said resignedly.
What does he want this time?
There wasn't loads of time, so I didn't get all coy with the subject matter.
He's worried about you. He thinks you may be in danger.
Erwin arched his eyebrows.
From what?
I just looked at him. His expression suddenly turned into a scowl, and the air around grew absolutely thick with energy that seethed for a point of discharge.
Wait. This is about Connie?
I couldn't answer him for a second. The air felt so close. The last time I'd felt this much latent, waiting power. I'd been standing next to my old mentor, Ebenezer McCoy, when he was gathering his strength for a spell. That pretty much answered my questions about River Shoulder's people having access to magical power. The kid was a freaking dynamo of it. I had to be careful.
I didn't want to be the guy who was unlucky enough to ground out that storm cloud of waiting power. So I answered Irwin cautiously and calmly. I'm not sure yet. But I know for a fact that she's not exactly what she seems to be. His nostrils flared, and I saw him make an effort to remain collected. His voice was fairly even.
Meaning what?
Meaning I'm not sure yet, I said.
So what, you're going to hang around here butting into my life?
I held up both hands.
It isn't like that. It's just like that, Irwin said. My dad spends my whole life anywhere else but here. And now he thinks he can just decide when to intrude on it?
Irwin, I said, I'm not here to try to make you do anything. He asked me to look in on you. I promised I would, and that's all.
He scowled for a moment, then smoothed that expression away.
No sense in being mad at the messenger, I guess, he said.
What do you mean about Connie?
She is... I faltered there.
You don't just sit down with a guy and tell him, hey, your girlfriend's a vampire, could you pass the ketchup?
I sighed.
Look, Irwin. Everybody sees the world a certain way. And we all kinda, well, we all sorta decide together what's real and what isn't real. Right?
Magic's real,
Irwin said impatiently. Monsters are real. Supernatural stuff actually exists. You're a professional wizard. I blinked at him several times.
What?
He asked and smiled gently. Don't let the brow ridge fool you. I'm not an idiot, man. You think you can walk into my life the way you have, twice, and not leave me with an itch to scratch? You made me ask questions. I went and got answers.
How?
I asked.
Wasn't hard. There's an internet.
And this organization called the Paranet of all the cockamamie things that got started a few years ago. Took me like 10 minutes to find it online and start reading through their message boards. I can't believe everyone in the world doesn't see this stuff. It's not like anyone is trying very hard to keep it secret.
People don't want to know the truth, I said. That makes it simple to hide.
Wow, 10 minutes, really? I guess I'm not really an internet-y person.
Internet-y,
Irwin said seriously.
I guess you aren't.
I waved a hand. Irwin, you need to know this. Connie isn't. The pretty vampire plopped herself back down into Irwin's lap and kissed his cheek.
Isn't what?
The kind to stray, I said smoothly. I was just telling Irwin how much I'd like to steal you away from him, but I figure you're the sort who doesn't play that kind of game.
True enough.
She agreed cheerfully. I know where I want to sleep tonight. Maybe it was unconscious the way she wriggled when she said it, but Irwin's eyes got a slightly glazed look to them. I remembered being that age. A girl like Connie would have been a mind-numbing distraction to me back then, even if she hadn't been a vampire. And Irwin was clearly in love, or as close to it as he could manage through the haze of hormones surrounding him. Reasoning with him wasn't going to accomplish anything, unless I made him angry. Passion's a huge force when you're Irwin's age, and I'd taken enough beatings for one lifetime. I'd never be able to explain the danger to him. He just didn't have a frame of reference. He just didn't know. I stared at Connie for a second with my mouth open.
What? She asked.
You don't know, I said.
Know what? She asked.
You don't know that you're...
I shook my head and said to Erwin,
she doesn't know.
Hang on, Dean said. Why is that significant?
Vampires are just like people until the first time they feed, I said. Connie didn't know that bad things would happen when she did.
What kind of bad things?
The first time they feed, they don't really know it's coming. They have no control over it, no restraint. And whoever they feed on dies as a result.
So she was the threat that Bigfoot dreamed about?
I'm getting to it.
Erwin's expression had darkened again into a glower, almost exactly like River Shoulders, and he stood up. Connie was frowning at me as she was abruptly displaced.
Don't know what... Oof, Pounder!
We're done, Erwin said to me.
His voice wasn't exactly threatening, but it was absolutely certain, and his leashed anger all but made the air crackle.
Nice to see you again, Harry. Tell my dad to call, or write, or do anything but try to tell me how to live my life.
Connie blinked at him.
Wait, what's wrong?
Erwin left a few 20s on the table and said,
we're going.
What? What happened?
We're going, Erwin said. This time he did sound a little angry.
Connie's bewilderment suddenly shifted into some flavor of outrage. She narrowed her lovely eyes and snapped,
I am not your pet, Pounder.
I'm not trying to...
Erwin took a slow, deep breath and said more calmly,
I'm upset. I need some space. I'll explain when I calm down, but we need to go.
She folded her arms and said, go calm down then. But I'm not going to be rude to our guest.
Erwin looked at me and said,
we going to have a problem?
Wow. The kid had learned a lot about the world since the last time I'd seen him. He recognized that I wasn't a playful puppy dog. He realized that if I'd been sent to protect him, and I thought Connie was a threat, that I might do something about it. And he'd just told me that if I did, he was going to object. Strenuously. No protests, no threats, just letting me know that he knew the score and was willing to do something about it if I made him. The guys who are seriously capable handle themselves like that.
No problem, I said and made it a promise. If I think something needs to be done, we'll talk first.
The set of his shoulders eased and he nodded at me. Then he turned and stalked out. People watched him go warily. Connie shook her head slowly and asked,
what did you say?
I said, I think he feels like his dad is intruding on his life.
You don't say.
She shook her head.
That's not your fault.
He's usually so collected. Why is he acting like such a jerk?
Issues, I said, shrugging. Everyone has a parental issue or two.
Still, it's beneath him to behave that way.
She shook her head.
Sometimes he makes me want to slap him.
But I'd need to get a chair to stand on.
I don't take it personally,
I assured her. Don't worry.
It was about me, she said quietly. Wasn't it? It's about something I don't know.
I said. It was just possible that maybe I'd made a bad call when I decided to meddle between River and his kid. It wasn't my place to shake the pillars of Irwin's life, or Connie's for that matter. It was going to be hard enough on her to find out about her supernatural heritage. She didn't need to have the news broken to her by a stranger on top of that. You'd think that, after years as a professional, I'd know enough to just take River's money, help out his kid, and call it a night. Maybe we should walk, I suggested. Sure. We left and started walking the streets of downtown Norman. The place was alive and growing, like a lot of college towns. Plenty of old buildings, some railroad tracks, lots of cracks in the asphalt and the sidewalks. The shops and restaurants had that improvised look that a business district gets when it outlives its original intended purpose and subsequent generations of enterprise take over the space. We walked in silence for several moments, until Connie finally said,
"He's not an angry person. He's usually so calm. But when something finally gets to him..."
"It's hard for him," I said. "He's huge, and he's very strong, and he knows it. If he loses control of himself, someone could get hurt. He doesn't like the thought of that. So when he starts feeling angry, it makes him tense, afraid. He's more upset about the fact that he feels so angry than about anything I said or did." Connie looked up at me pensively for a long moment. Then she said,
"Most people wouldn't realize that."
I shrugged.
"What don't I know?" she asked.
I shook my head. "I'm not sure it's my place to tell you.
But it's about me."
"Yeah." She smiled faintly.
"Then shouldn't I be the one who gets to decide?"
I thought about that one for a moment. "Connie, you're mostly right. But some things once said can't be unsaid. Let me think about it." She didn't answer. The silence made me uncomfortable. I tried to chat my way clear of it. "How'd you meet Irwin?" The question, or maybe the subject matter, seemed to relax her a little.
"In a closet at a party. Someone spiked the punch. Neither of us had ever been drunk before, and..." Her cheeks turned a little pink. "And he's just so damned sexy."
"A lot of people wouldn't think so," I noted. She waved a hand.
"He's not pretty, I know that. It's not about that. There's this energy in him. It's chemical. Assurance. Power. Not just muscles. It's who he is."
Her cheeks turned a little pink. It wasn't exactly love at first sight, I guess.
But once the hangover cleared up, that happened too.
"So you love him?" I asked. Her smile widened and her eyes shone the way a young woman's eyes ought to shine. She spoke with calm, simple certainty.
"He's the one."
About 20 things to say leapt to my mind. I was going to say something about how she was too young to make that kind of decision. I thought about how she hadn't been out on her own for very long and how she had no idea where her relationship with Irwin was going to lead. I was going to tell her that only time could tell her if she and Irwin were good for one another and ready to be together, to make that kind of decision. I could have said something about how she needed to stop and think,
not make blanket statements about her emotions and the future. That was when I realized that everything I would have said was something I would have said to a young woman in love. Not to a vampire. Not only that, but I heard something in her voice or saw something in her face that told me that my aged wisdom was, at least in this case, dead wrong. My instincts were telling me something that my rational brain had missed. The kids had something real. I mean, maybe it hadn't gotten off on the most pure and virtuous foot, but that wasn't anything lethal in a relationship. The way they related to one another now, there was a connection there. You can imagine saying their names as a unit, and it fit. Connie and Erwin. Maybe they had some growing to do, but what they had was real. Not that it mattered. Being in love didn't change the facts. First, that Connie was a vampire. Second, that vampires had to feed. Third, they fed upon their lovers.
Hold on, Dean said. You missed something.
Huh?
Girl's a vampire, right?
Yeah.
So, Dean said, she met the kid in a closet at a party. They already got it on. She done had her first time.
I frowned.
Yeah. So how come Kid Bigfoot wasn't dead?
I nodded. Exactly. It bothered me, too.
The girl was in love with Erwin, and it meant she was dangerous to him. Hell, she was dangerous to almost everyone.
She wasn't even entirely human. How could I possibly spring something that big on her? At the same time, how could I not? I should have taken the gold. I muttered to myself. What? She asked.
That was when the town car pulled up to the curb a few feet ahead of us. Two men got out of the front seat. They wore expensive suits and had thick necks. One of them hadn't had his suit fitted properly. I could see the slight bulge of a sidearm in a shoulder holster. That one stood on the sidewalk and stared at me, his hands clasped in front of him. The driver went around to the rear passenger door and opened it.
Oh, Connie said. Marvelous. This is all I need.
Who's that? I asked.
My father.
The man who got out of the back of the limo wore a pearl-gray suit that made his thug's outfits look like second-hand clothing. He was slim, a bit over 6 feet tall, and his haircut probably cost him more than I made in a week. His hair was dark with a single swath of silver at each temple, and his skin was weathered and deeply tanned. He wore rings on most of his manicured fingers, all of them sporting large stones.
Hi, Daddy,
Connie said, smiling. She sounded pleasant enough, but she turned herself very slightly away from the man as she spoke. A rule of thumb for reading body language is that almost no one can totally hide physical reflections of their state of mind. They can only minimize the signs of it in their posture and movements. If you mentally exaggerate and magnify their body language, it tells you something about what they're thinking. Connie clearly didn't want to talk to this man. She was ready to flee from her own father should it become necessary. It told me something about the guy. I was almost sure I wasn't going to like him. He approached the girl, smiling, and after a micro-hesitation, they exchanged a brief hug. It didn't look like something they'd practiced much. Connie, the man said, smiling.
He had the same mild drawl his daughter did. He tilted his head to one side and regarded her thoughtfully.
You went blonde. It's charming.
Thank you, Daddy, Connie said.
She was smiling, too. Neither one of them looked sincere to me.
I didn't know you were in town. If you'd called, we could have made an evening of it.
Spur-of-the-moment thing, he said easily. I hope you don't mind.
No, of course not.
Both of them were lying. Parental issues indeed. How's that boy you'd taken up with? Irving.
Irwin, Connie said in a poisonously pleasant tone. He's great. Maybe even better than that.
He frowned at that and said,
I see. But he's not here.
He had homework tonight, Connie lied.
That drew a small, sly smile out of the man.
I see.
Who's your friend? He asked pleasantly, without actually looking at me.
Oh, Connie said. Harry, this is my father, Charles Barrowwill. Daddy, this is Harry Dresden.
Hi, I said brightly. Barrowwill's eyes narrowed to sudden slits, and he took a short, hard breath as he looked at me. He then flicked his eyes left and right around him, as if looking for a good place to dive, or maybe a hostage to seize.
What a pleasure, Mr. Dresden,
he said, his voice suddenly tight.
What brings you out to Oklahoma?
I heard it was a nice place for perambulating, I said. Behind Barrowwill, his guards had picked up on the tension. Both of them had become very still. Barrowwill was quiet for a moment, as if trying to parse some kind of meaning from my words. Heavy seconds ticked by, like the quiet before a shootout in an old western. A tumbleweed went rolling by in the street. I am not even kidding. Man, Oklahoma. Then Barrowwill took a slow breath and said to Connie,
Darling, I'd like to speak to you for a few moments if you have time.
Actually,
Connie began.
Now, please,
Barrowwill said. There was something ugly under the surface of his pleasant tone.
The car. I'll give you a ride back to the dorms.
Connie folded her arms and scowled.
I'm entertaining someone from out of town, Daddy. I can't just leave him here.
One of the guard's hands twitched.
Don't be difficult, Connie,
Barrowwill said.
I don't want to make a scene.
His eyes never left me as he spoke, and I got his message loud and clear. He was taking the girl with him, and he was willing to make things get messy if I tried to stop him.
It's okay, Connie, I said. I've been to Norman before. I can find my way to a hotel easily enough.
You're sure?
Connie said.
Definitely. Herman?
Barrowwill said. The driver opened the passenger door again and stood next to it attentively. He kept his eyes on me and one hand dangled, clearly ready to go for his gun. Connie looked back and forth between me and her father for a moment, then sighed audibly and walked over to the car. She slid in and Herman closed the door behind her.
I recognize you,
I said pleasantly to Barrowwill.
You were at the Wraith Deeps when Scavis and Malvora tried to pull off their coup. Front row, all the way on one end in the Wraith cheering section.
You have an excellent memory,
Barrowwill said.
Got out in one piece, did you?
The vampire smiled without humor.
What are you doing with my daughter?
Taking a walk, I said. Talking.
You have nothing to say to her. In the interests of peace between the court and the council, I'm willing to ignore this intrusion into my territory. Go in peace. Right now.
You never told her, did you? I asked. Never told her what she was. One of his jaw muscles twitched.
It is not our way.
Nah, I said.
You wait until the first time they get Twitter-pated, experiment with sex, and kill whoever it is they're with.
Little harsh on the kids, isn't it?
Connie is not some mortal cow. She is a vampire. The initiation builds character. She will need to survive and prosper.
If it was good enough for you, it's good enough for her.
Mortal, Barrowwill said. You simply cannot understand. I'm her father. It's my obligation to prepare her for her life. The initiation is something she needs.
I lifted my eyebrows.
Holy, that's what happened, isn't it? You sent her off to school to boink some poor kid to death. Hell, I bet you had the punch spiked at that party. Except the kid didn't die. So now you're in town to figure out what the hell went wrong.
Barrowwill's eyes darkened and he shook his head.
This is no business of yours. Leave.
See, that's the thing, I said. It is my business. My client is worried about his kid.
Barrowwill narrowed his eyes again. Irving.
Irwin. I corrected him.
Go back to Chicago, wizard, he said. You're in my territory now.
This isn't a smart move for you, I said. The kid's connected. If anything bad happens to him, you're in for trouble.
Is that a threat? He asked. I shook my head.
Chuck, I've got no objection to working things out peaceably. And I've got no objection to doing it the other way. If you know my reputation, then you know what a sincere guy I am.
Perhaps I should kill you now.
Here in public, I asked, all these witnesses? You aren't going to do that.
No.
No. Even if you win, you lose. You're just hoping to scare me off.
I nodded toward his goons. Ghouls, right?
It's gonna take more than two, Chuck. Hell, I like fighting ghouls. No matter what I do to them, I never feel bad about it afterward.
Barrowwill missed the reference, like the monsters usually do.
He looked at me, then at his Rolex. I'll give you until midnight to leave the state. After that, you're gone. One way or another.
Hang on, I said. I'm terrified. Let me catch my breath.
Barrowwill's eyes shifted color slightly from a deep green to a much paler, angrier shade of green gold.
I react poorly to those who threaten my family's well-being, Dresden.
Yeah, you're a regular Ozzie Nelson.
John Walton. Ben Cartwright.
Excuse me?
Mr. Drummond?
Charles in charge?
No? What are you blabbering about?
Hell's bells, man!
Don't any of you white-cord bozos ever watch television? I'm giving you pop reference gold here. Gold!
Barrowell stared at me with opaque reptilian eyes. Then he said, simply, "Midnight." He took two steps back before he turned his back on me and got into his car. His goons both gave me hard looks before they too got into the car and pulled away. I watched the car roll out. Despite the attitude I'd given Barrowell, I knew better than to take him lightly. Any vampire is a dangerous foe, and one of them with holdings and resources and his own personal brute squad was more so. Not only that, but from his point of view, I was messing around with his little girl's best interests. The vampires of the White Court were, to a degree, as dangerous as they were because they were partly human. They had human emotions, human motivations, human reactions. Barrowell could be as irrationally protective of his family as anyone else, except that they were also inhuman. All of those human drives were intertwined with a parasitic spirit they called a hunger, where all the power and hunger of their vampire parts came from. Take one part human faults and insecurities and add it to one part inhuman power and motivation, what do you get? Trouble.
Barrowell, Officer Dean asked me. The oil guy? He keeps a stable of congressmen.
Yeah, probably the same guy, I said. All vampires like having money and status. It makes their lives easier.
Dean snorted. Every vampire and every non-vampire.
Ha, I said.
Point. You were in a fix, he said. Tell the girl you might wreck her. Don't tell her, and you might wreck her and Kid Bigfoot both. Either way, somebody's dad has a bone to pick with you.
Pretty much.
Seems to me like a smart guy would have washed his hands of the whole mess and left town.
I shrugged. Yeah, but I was the only guy there.
Forest isn't exactly the dominant terrain in Norman, but there are a few trees here and there. The point where I'd agreed to meet with River Shoulders was in the center of the Oliver Wildlife Preserve, which was a stand of woods that had been donated to the university for research purposes. As I hiked out into the little wood, it occurred to me that meeting River Shoulders there was like rendezvousing with Jaws in a kiddie wading pool. But he'd picked the spot, so whatever floated the big guy's boat.
It was dark out, and I drew my silver pentacle amulet off my neck to use for light. A whisper of will and a muttered word, and the little symbol glowed with a dim blue light that would let me walk without bumping into a tree. It took me maybe 5 minutes to get to approximately the right area, and River Shoulder's soft murmur of greeting came to me out of the dark. We sat down together on a fallen tree, and I told him what I'd learned. He sat in silence for maybe 2 minutes after I finished.
Then he said, "My son has joined himself to a parasite."
I felt a flash of mild outrage. "You could think of it that way," I said.
"What other way is there?"
"That he's joined himself to a girl. The parasite just came along for the ride." River Shoulders exhaled a huge breath. It sounded like those pneumatic machines they use to elevate cars at the repair shop.
"I see. In your view, the girl not dangerous. She is innocent.
She's both,
I said. She can't help being born what she is any more than you or I.
River Shoulders grunted.
Have your people encountered the White Court before?
He grunted again.
Because the last time I helped Irwin out, I remember being struck by the power of his aura when he was only 14. A long-term draining spell that should have killed him only left him sleepy.
I eyed him.
But I don't feel anything around you. Stands to reason your aura would be an order of magnitude greater than your kid's.
That's why you've been careful never to touch me.
You're keeping your power hidden from me, aren't you?
Maybe.
I snorted.
Just the kind of answer I'd expect from a wizard.
It is not something we care for outsiders to know, he said. And we are not wizards. We see things differently than mortals. You people are dangerous.
I said, and glanced up at his massive form beside mine. Between the two of us, I'm the dangerous one.
Like a child waving around his father's gun,
River Shoulders said.
Something in his voice became gentler.
Though some of you are better than others about it, I admit.
My point is, I said, the kid's got a life force like few I've seen. When Connie's hunger awakened, she fed on him without any kind of restraint. And he wound up with nothing worse than a hangover.
Could be that he could handle life with her just fine. River Shoulders nodded slowly. His expression might have been thoughtful. It was too dark and his features too blunt and chiseled to be sure.
The girl seems genuinely fond of him, and he of her. I mean, I'm not an expert in these things, but they seem to like each other. And even when they have a difference of opinions, they fight fair. That's a good sign. I squinted at him. Do you really think he's in danger?
Yes, River Shoulders said. They have to kill him now.
I blinked. What?
This creature. This Barrow will.
Yeah?
It sent its child to this place with the intention that she meet a young man and feed upon him and unknowingly kill him.
Yeah.
River Shoulders shook his huge head sadly.
What kind of monster does that to its children?
Vampires, I said. It isn't uncommon from what I hear.
Because they hurt,
River Shoulders said.
Barrow will remembers his own first lover. He remembers being with her. He remembers her death. And his Wendigo has had its hand on his heart ever since. It shaped his life.
Wendigo?
River Shoulders waved a hand.
General term. Spirit of hunger. Can't ever be sated.
Ah, gotcha.
Now Barrow will. He had his father tell him that this was how it had to be. That it had to be that way to make him a good vampire. So this thing that turned him into a murdering monster is actually a good thing. He spends his whole life trying to convince himself of that.
River nodded slowly. What happens when his child does something differently?
I felt like a moron.
It means that what his father told him was a lie. It means that maybe he didn't have to be like he is. It means that he's been lying to himself about everything.
River's shoulders spread his hands palm up as if presenting the fact.
That kind of father has to make his children in his own image. He has to make the lie true.
He has to make sure Connie kills Irwin, I said.
We've got to get him out of there. Maybe both of them.
How? Rivershoulder said. She doesn't know. He only knows a little. Neither knows enough to be wise enough to run.
They shouldn't have to run, I growled.
Avoiding a fight is always better than not avoiding one.
Disagree, I said. Some fights should be sought out, and fought, and won.
Rivershoulder shook his head.
Your father's gun.
I sensed a deep current of resistance in Rivershoulder's on this subject, one that I would never be able to bridge. I suspected. River just wasn't a fighter.
Wouldn't you agree it was wisest if they both fled?
In this case, it might, yeah. But I think it would only delay the confrontation. Guys like Barrowwill have long arms. If he obsesses over it, he'll find them sooner or later.
I have no right to take his child from him, Rivershoulder said. I'm only interested in Irwin.
Well, I'm not going to be able to separate them, I said. Irwin nearly started swinging at me when I went anywhere close to that subject.
I paused, then added, but he might listen to you.
Rivershoulder shook his head. He's right. I got no right to walk in and smash his life to splinters after being so far away so long. He'd never listen to me. He's got a lot of anger in him. Maybe for good reasons.
You're his father, I said. That might carry more weight than you think.
I should not have involved you in this, he said. I apologize for that wizard. You should go. Let me sort this out on my own.
I eyed Rivershoulder's.
The big guy was powerful, sure, but he was also slow. He took his time making decisions. He played things out with enormous patience. He was clearly ambivalent over what kind of involvement he should have with his son. It might take him months of observation and cogitation to make a choice.
Most of us don't live that way. I was sure Barrowwill didn't.
If the vampire was moving, he might be moving now. Like, right now.
In this particular instance, Rivershoulder's, you are not thinking clearly, I said.
Action must be taken soon. Preferably tonight.
I will be what I am,
Rivers said firmly. I stood up from the log and nodded.
Okay, I said.
Me too.
I put in a call to my fellow warden, Wild Bill Myers, in Dallas, but got an answering service. I left a message that I was in Norman and needed his help, but I had little faith that he'd show up in time. The real downside to being a wizard is that
We void the warranties of anything technological every time we sneeze. Cell phones are worse than useless in our hands. And it makes communications a challenge at times, though that was far from the only possible obstacle. If Bill was in, he'd have picked up his phone. He had a big area for his beat and likely had problems of his own, but since Dallas was only 3 hours away, assuming his car didn't break down, I could hold out hope that he might roll in by morning. So I got my busted-up old Volkswagen, picked up a prop, and drove up to the campus alone. I parked somewhere where I would probably get a ticket. I planned to ignore it. Anarchists have a much easier time finding parking spots. I got out and walked toward one of the smaller dorm buildings on campus. I didn't have my wizard staff with me, on account of how weird it looked to walk around with one, but my blasting rod was hanging from its tie inside my leather duster. I doubted I would need it, but better to have it and not need it than the other way around. I got my prop and trudged across a short bit of turquoise-tinted grass to the honors dorms, where Irwin lived. They were tiny for that campus, maybe 5 stories, with the building laid out in 4 right-angled halls, like a plus sign. The door was locked. There's always that kind of security in a dorm building these days. I rapped on the glass with my knuckles until a passing student noticed. I held up a cardboard box from the local Pizza Express and tried to look like I needed a break. I needn't have tried so hard. The kid's eyes were bloodshot and glassy. He was baked on something. He opened the door for me without blinking. "Thanks."
"No problem,"
he said. "He was supposed to meet me at the doors," I said. "You see a guy named, I checked the receipt that was taped to the box. "Irwin Pounder?"
"Pounder, the kid said. "He'll be in his room. 4th floor, south hall, 3rd door on the left. Just listen for the noise."
"Music?"
He tittered. "Not exactly."
I thanked him and ambled up the stairs, which were getting to be a lot harder on my knees than they used to be. Maybe I needed orthopedic shoes or something. I got to the 2nd floor before I felt it. There was a tension in the air, something that made my heart speed up and my skin feel hot. A few steps farther, and I started breathing faster and louder. It wasn't until I got to the 3rd floor that I remembered that the most dangerous aspect of a psychic assault is that the victim almost never realizes that it's actually happening. I stopped and threw up my mental defenses in a sudden panic, and the surge of adrenaline and fear suddenly overcame the tremors of restless need that I'd been feeling. The air was thick with psychic power of a nature I'd experienced once before, back in the Wraith Deeps. That was when Lara Wraith had unleashed the full force of her come-hither against her own father, the White King, drowning his mind in imposed lust and desire to please her. He'd been her puppet ever since. This was the same form of attack, though there were subtle differences. It had to be Barrowwill. He'd moved even faster than I'd feared. I kept my mental shields up as I picked up my pace. By the time I reached the 4th floor, I heard the noise the amiable Toker had mentioned. It was sex. Loud sex. A lot of it. I dropped the pizza and drew my blasting rod. It took me about 5 seconds to realize what was happening. Barrowwill must have been pushing Connie psychically, forcing her to continue feeding and feeding after she would normally have stopped. He wanted to kill Irwin like a good little vampire, and the overflow was spilling out onto the entire building.
Not that it takes much to make college kids interested in sex, but in this instance, they had literally gone wild. When I looked down the four hallways, doors were standing wide open. Couples and, well, the only word that really applied was clusters of kids were in the act, some of them right out in the hall. Imagine an act of lust. It was going on in at least two of those four hallways. I turned down Irwin's hall, channeling my will into my blasting rod. And yes, I'm aware of the Freudian irony here. The carved runes along its length began to burn with silver and scarlet light as the power built up in it. A white court vampire is practically a pussycat compared to some of the other breeds on the planet. But I'd once seen one of them twist a pair of 50-pound steel dumbbells around one another to make a point. I might not have much time to throw down on Barrowwill in these narrow quarters, and my best chance was to put him down hard the instant I saw him. I moved forward as silently as I knew how, stepping around a pair of couples who were breaking some sort of municipal statute, I was sure. Then I leaned back and kicked open the door to Irwin's room. The place looked like a small tornado had gone through it. Books and clothing and bedclothes and typical dorm room decor had been scattered everywhere. The chair next to a small study desk had been knocked over. A laptop computer lay on its side, showing what I'd once been told was a blue screen of death. The bed had fallen onto its side, where two of the legs appeared to have snapped off. Connie and Irwin were there, and the haze of lust rolling off the ingenue succubus was a second psychic cyclone. I barely managed to push away. Irwin had her pinned against the wall in a corner. His muscles strained against his skin, and his breath came in dry, labored gasps, but he never stopped moving. He wasn't being gentle, and Connie apparently didn't mind. Her eyes were a shade of silver, metallic silver, as if they'd been made of chrome, reflecting the room around her like tiny warped mirrors. She'd sunk her fingers into the drywall to the second knuckle on either side of her to hang on, and her body was rolling in a strained arch in time with his motion. They were gratuitously enthusiastic about the whole thing, and I hadn't gotten laid in forever. "Irwin!" I shouted. Shockingly, I didn't capture his attention.
"Connie!"
I didn't capture hers either. I couldn't let the process continue. I had no idea how long it might take or how resistant to harm Irwin might be, but it would be stupid to do nothing and hope for the best. While I was trying to figure out how to break it up before someone lost an eye, I heard the door of the room across the hall open behind me. The sights and sounds and the haze of psychic influence had my mental processes running at less than peak performance. I didn't process the sound into a threat until Barrowwill slugged me on the back of the head with something that felt like a lump of solid ivory. I don't even remember hitting the floor. When I woke up, I had a Sasquatch-sized headache. My wrists and ankles were killing me. Half a dozen of Barrowwill's goons were all literally kneeling on me to hold me down. Every single one of them had a knife pressed close to one of my major arteries. Also, my pants had shrunk by several sizes. I was still in Irwin's dorm room, but things had changed. Irwin was on his back on the floor, Connie astride him. Her features had changed, shifted subtly,
Her skin seemed to glow with pale light. Her eyes were empty white spheres. Her cheekbones stood out more harshly against her face. And her hair was a sweat-dampened wild mane that clung to her cheeks and her parted lips. She was moving as if in slow motion, her fingernails digging into Irwin's chest. Barrowell's psychic assault was still underway, and Connie's presence had become something so vibrant and penetrating that for a second I thought there might have been a minor earthquake going on. I had to get to that girl. I had to. If I didn't, I was going to lose my mind with need. My instant reaction upon opening my eyes was to struggle to get closer to her on pure reflex. The goons held me down, and I screamed in protest. But at least being a captive had kept me from doing something stupid, and gave me an instant cold realization that my shields were down. I threw them up again as hard as I could, but the Barrowells had been in my head too long. I barely managed to grab hold of my reason. The kid looked awful. His eyes were glazed. He wasn't moving with Connie so much as his body was randomly shaking in independent spasms. His head lolled from one side to the other, and his mouth was open. A strand of drool ran from his mouth to the floor. Barrowell had righted the fallen chair. He sat upon it with one ankle resting on his other knee, his arms folded. His expression was detached, clinical, as he watched his daughter killing the young man she loved.
"Barrowell," I said.
My voice came out hoarse and rough.
"Stop this!"
The vampire directed his gaze to me and shook his head.
"It's after midnight, Dresden. It's time for Cinderella to return to her real life."
"You son of a bitch!"
I snarled.
"She's killing him!"
A small smile touched one corner of his mouth.
"Yes. Beautifully. Her hunger is quite strong." He made a vague gesture with one hand.
"Does he seem upset about it?"
"He's immortal. And mortals are all born to die. The only question is how and in how much pain."
"There's this life thing that happens in between,"
I snarled.
"And many more where his came from."
Barrowell's eyes went chill.
"His and yours."
"What do you mean?"
"When she's finished, we leave. Your dessert."
A lump of ice settled in my stomach and I swallowed. All things considered, I was becoming a little worried about the outcome of this situation. Talk, Harry. Keep him talking. You've never met a vampire who didn't love the sound of his own voice. Something could change the situation if you play for time.
"Why not do it before I woke up?"
I asked.
"This way is more efficient," Barrowell said. "If a young athlete takes ecstasy and his heart fails, there may be a candlelight vigil, but there won't be an investigation. Two dead men, one of them a private investigator, there will be questions."
He shrugged a shoulder.
"And I don't care for you to bequest me your death curse, wizard. But once Connie has you, you won't have enough left of your mind to speak your own name, much less utter a curse."
"The wraiths are going to kill you if you drag the court and the council into direct opposition," I said.
The Wraiths will never know. I own 20 ghouls, Dresden, and they're always hungry. What they leave of your corpse won't fill a moist sponge. Connie suddenly ceased moving altogether. Her skin had become pure ivory white. She shuddered, her breaths coming in ragged gasps. She tilted her head back, and a low, throaty moan came out of her throat. I've had sex that wasn't as good as Connie sounded. Damn it, Dresden, focus. I was out of time.
The council will find out, Chuck. They're wizards. Finding unfindable information is what they do.
He smirked. I think we both know that their reputation is very well constructed.
We did both know that, damn it. You think nobody's going to miss me? I asked. I have friends, you know.
Barrow Will suddenly leaned forward, focusing on Connie, his eyes becoming a few shades lighter. Perhaps, Dresden. But your friends are not here. Then, there was a crash so loud that it shook the building. Barrow Will's sleek, black Lincoln Town Car came crashing through the dorm room's door, taking a sizable portion of the wall with it. The ghouls holding me down were scattered by the debris, and fine dust filled the air. I started coughing at once, but I could see what had happened. The car had come through from the far side of this wing of the dorm, smashing through the room where Barrow Will had waited in ambush. The car had crossed the hall and wound up with its bumper and front tires resting inside Irwin's room. It had smashed a massive hole in the outer brick wall of the building, leaving it gaping open to the night. That got everyone's attention. For an instant, the room was perfectly silent and perfectly still. The ghoul chauffeur still sat in the driver's seat, only his head wobbled loosely, leaning at a right angle to the rest of his neck. I cackled, wheezing. Moron. A large figure leapt up to the hole in the exterior wall and landed in the room across the hall, hitting with a crunch only slightly less massive than the car had made. I swear to you, if I'd heard that sound effect they used to use when Steve Austin jumped somewhere, I wouldn't have been shocked. The other room was unlit, and the newcomer was a massive, threatening shadow. He slapped a hand the size of a big cookie tray on the floor and let out a low rumbling sound like nothing I'd ever heard this side of an amplified bass guitar. It was music. You couldn't have written it in musical notation any more than you could write the music of a thunderstorm or write lyrics to the song of a running stream. But it was music nonetheless. Power, like nothing I'd ever encountered, surged out from that impact. A deep, shuddering wave that passed visibly through the dust in the air. The ceiling and the walls and the floor sang in resonance with the note and impact alike, and Barrow Will's psychic assault was swept away like a sand castle before the tide. Connie's eyes flooded with color, changing from pure, empty whiteness back to a rich blue as deep and rich as a glacial lake, and the humanity came flooding back into her features. The sense of wild panic in the air suddenly vanished, and for another timeless instant, everything, everything in that night went utterly silent and still. Holy crap! I've worked with magic for decades, and take it from me, it really isn't very different from anything else in life.
When you work with magic, you rapidly realize that it's far easier to disrupt than to create, far more difficult to mend than to destroy. Throw a stone into a glass-smooth lake, and ripples will wash over the whole thing. Making waves with magic instead of a rock would have been easy. But if you can make that lake smooth again, that's one hell of a trick. That surge of energy didn't attack anything or anybody. It didn't destroy Barrowwill's assault. It made the water smooth again. Strength of a river in his shoulders opened his eyes, and his fury made them burn like coals in the shadows. But he simply crouched, doing nothing. All of Barrowwill's goons remained still, wide eyes flicking from river to Barrowwill and back. "Back off, Chuck," I said. "He's giving you a chance to walk away. Take him up on it." The vampire's expression was completely blank as he stood among the debris. He stared at River Shoulders for maybe 3 seconds. And then I saw movement behind River Shoulders. Clawed hands began to grip the edges of the hole behind River. Wicked, bulging red eyes appeared. Monstrous-looking things in the same general shape as a human appeared in complete silence. Ghouls. Barrowwill didn't have 6 goons with him. He'd brought them all. Barrowwill spat toward River, bared his teeth, and screamed, "Kill it!" And it was on. Everything went completely insane. The human-shaped ghouls in the room bounded forward, their faces and limbs contorting, tearing their way out of their cheap suits as they assumed their true forms. More ghouls poured in through the hole in the wall like a swarm of panicked roaches. I couldn't get an accurate count of the enemy. The action was too fast. But 20 sounded about right. 20 flesh-rending, superhumanly strong and durable predators flung themselves onto River Shoulders in an overwhelming wave. He vanished beneath a couple of tons of hungry ghoul. It was not a fair fight. Barrowwill should have brought more goons. There was an enormous bellow, a sound that could only have been made by a truly massive set of lungs. And ghouls exploded outward from River Shoulders like so much hideous shrapnel. Several were flung back out of the building. Others slammed into walls with so much force that they shattered the drywall. One of them went through the ceiling, then fell limply back down into the room, only to be caught by the neck in one of River Shoulders' massive hands. He squeezed, crushing the ghoul's neck like soft clay, and there was an audible pop. The ghoul spasmed once, then River flung the corpse into the nearest batch of monsters. After that, it was clobbering time. Barrowwill moved fast, seizing Connie and darting out the door. I looked around frantically and spotted one of the knives the goons had been holding before they transformed. My hands and ankles had been bound in those plastic restraining strips, and I could barely feel my fingers. But I managed to pick up the knife and cut my legs free. Then I put it on the front bumper of the Lincoln, stepped on it with 1 foot to hold in place, and after a few moments managed to cut my hands loose as well. The dorm sounded like a medley of pay-per-view wrestling and the island of Dr. Moreau. Ghouls shrieked, River Shoulders roared, very, very disoriented students screamed. The walls and floor shook with impact again and again as River Shoulders flung ghouls around like so many softballs. Ghoulish blood spattered the walls and the ceiling. green, brown, and putrid-smelling, and as strong as he was, River Shoulders wasn't pitching a shutout. The ghoul's claws and fangs had sunk into him, covering him in punctures and lacerations, and his scarlet blood mixed with theirs on the various surfaces. I tried to think unobtrusive thoughts, stayed low, and went to Irwin. He still looked awful, but he was breathing hard and steady, and he'd already begun blinking and trying to focus his eyes. "Irwin!" I shouted. "Irwin! Where's her purse?"
"Wazah," Irwin mumbled.
"Connie's purse! I've got to help Connie! Where's her purse?" Irwin's eyes almost focused.
"Connie? Oh, never mind."
I started ransacking the dorm room until I found Connie's handbag. She had a brush in it. The brush was liberally festooned with her blonde hairs. I swept a circle into the dust on the floor, tied the hair around my pentacle amulet, and invested the circle with a whisper of will. Then I quickly worked the tracking spell that was generally my bread and butter when I was doing investigator stuff. When I released the magic, it rushed down into Connie's borrowed hair, and my amulet lurched sharply out of plumb and held itself steady at a 30 or 40 degree angle. Connie went that-a-way. I ducked a flying ghoul, leapt over a dying ghoul, and staggered down the hall at my best speed while the blood went back into my feet. I had gone down one whole flight of stairs without falling when the angle on the amulet changed again. Barrel Will had gone down one floor, then taken off down one of the residential hallways toward the fire escape at the far end. He'd bypassed security by ripping the door off its hinges, then flinging it into the opposite wall. Kids were scattering out of the hallway, looking either horrified or disappointed. Some both. Barrow Will had reached the far end, carrying his daughter over one shoulder, and was headed for the fire door. Barrow Will had been savvy enough to divest me of my accoutrements. But I was still a wizard, damn it, blasting rod or no. I drew up my will, aimed low, and snarled, "Forzare!" Pure kinetic force lashed invisibly through the air and caught Barrow Will at the ankles. It kicked both of his feet up into the air, and he took a pratfall onto the floor. Connie landed with a grunt and bounced to one side. She lay there dazed and blinking. Barrow Will slithered back up to his feet, spinning toward me and producing a pistol in one hand. I lurched back out of the line of fire as the gun barked twice, and bullets went by me with a double hiss. I went to my knees and bobbed my head out into the hall again for a quick peek, jerking it back immediately. Barrow Will was picking Connie up. His bullet went through the air where my head would have been if I'd been standing.
"Don't be a moron, Harry,"
I said. "You came for the kid. He's safe. That's all you were obligated to do. Let it go." "Oh, who am I kidding? There's a girl." I didn't have to beat the vampire. I just had to slow him down long enough for River Shoulders to catch up to him, assuming River did pursue. I took note of which wing Barrow Will was fleeing through and rushed down the stairs to the ground floor. Then I left the building and sprinted to the far end of that wing. Barrow Will slammed the emergency exit open and emerged from the building. He was moving fast, but he also had his daughter to carry, and she'd begun to resist him, kicking and thrashing, slowing him down. She tugged him off balance just as he shot at me again, and it went wide. I slashed at him with another surge of force, but this time, I wasn't aiming for his feet. I went for the gun. The weapon leapt out of his hands and went spinning away, shattering against the bricks of the dorm's outer wall. Another blast knocked Connie off his shoulder, and she let out a little shriek. Barrow Will staggered, then let out a snarl of frustration and charged me at a speed worthy of the Flash's understudy. I flung more force at him, but Barrowell bobbed to one side, evading the blast. I threw myself away from the vampire and managed to roll with the punch he sent at my head. He caught me an inch or two over one eyebrow, the hardest and most impact-resistant portion of the human skull. That, and the fact that I managed to rob it of a little of its power, meant that he only sent me spinning wildly away, my vision completely obscured by pain and little silver stars. He was furious, his power rolling over me like a sudden deluge of ice water, to the point where crystals of frost formed on my clothing. Barrowell followed up, his eyes murderous. And then, Bigfoot Irwin bellowed, "Connie!" and slammed into Barrowell at the hip, using his body as a living spear. Barrowell was flung to one side, and Irwin pressed his advantage, still screaming, coming down atop the vampire and pounding him with both fists in elemental violence, his sunken eyes mad with rage. "Connie! Connie!" I tried to rise but couldn't seem to make it past one knee. So all I could do was watch as the furious scion of River Shoulders unleashed everything he had on a ranking noble of the White Court. Barrowell could have been much stronger than a human being if he'd had the gas in the tank, but he'd spent his energy on his psychic assault, and it had drained him. He still thrashed powerfully, but he was no match for the enraged young man. Irwin slammed Barrowell's nose flat against his face. I saw one of the vampire's teeth go flying into the night air. Slightly too pale blood began to splash against Irwin's fists. Christ. If the kid killed Barrowell, the White Court would consider it an act of war. All kinds of horrible things could unfold. "Irwin!" I shouted. "Irwin, stop!" Kid Bigfoot didn't listen to me. I lurched closer to him, but only made it about 6 inches before my head whirled so badly that I fell onto my side. "Irwin, stop!" I looked around and saw Connie staring dazedly at the struggle. "Connie," I said, "stop him! Stop him!" Meanwhile, Irwin had beaten Barrowell to within an inch of his life, and now he raised his joined hands over his head, preparing for a sledgehammer blow to Barrowell's skull. A small pretty hand touched his wrist. "Irwin," Connie said gently. "Irwin, no."
"He tried," Irwin panted. "Tried. Hurt you."
"This isn't the way," Connie said.
"Bad man,"
Irwin growled. "But you aren't," Connie said, her voice very soft. "Irwin, he's still my daddy." Connie couldn't have physically stopped Irwin, but she didn't need to. The kid blinked several times, then looked at her. He slowly lowered his hands, and Connie leaned down to kiss his forehead gently. "Shh," she said. "Shh. I'm still here. It's over, baby. It's over."
"Connie,"
Irwin said, and leaned against her. I let out a huge sigh of relief and sank back onto the ground. My head hurt. Officer Dean stared at me for a while. He chewed on a toothpick and squinted at me.
Got some holes.
Yeah? I asked. Like what?
Like all those kids saw Bigfoot and them, whatchamacallits, ghouls.
How come they didn't say anything?
You walked in on them while they were all still trying to put their clothes back on. After flinging themselves into random sex with whoever happened to be close to them, they're all denying that this ever happened right now.
Huh. Dean said.
What about the ghoul corpses?
After Irwin dragged their boss up to the fight, the ghouls quit when they saw him. River Shoulders told them all to get out of his sight and take their dead with them.
They did.
Dean squinted and consulted a list.
Pounder's gone. So's Connie Barrowwill. Not officially missing or nothing. Not yet. But where are they?
I looked at Dean and shrugged. I'd seen ghouls in all kinds of situations before, but I'd never seen them whipped into submission. Ghouls fought to the grisly, messy end. That was what they did. But River Shoulders had been more than their match. He'd left several of them alive when he could have killed them to the last, and he'd found their breaking point when Irwin had dragged Barrowwill in by his hair. Ghouls could take a huge beating, but River Shoulders had given them one like I'd never seen. And when he ordered them to take their master and their dead and never to return, they'd snapped to it.
Thanks, Connie, I groaned as she settled me onto a section of convenient rubble. I was freezing. The frost on my clothes was rapidly melting away, but the chill had settled inward. The girl looked acutely embarrassed. But that wasn't in short supply in that dorm. That hallway was empty of other students for the moment, though. We had the place to ourselves, though I judged that the authorities would arrive in some form before long. Irwin came over with a dust-covered blanket and wrapped it around her. He scrounged a ragged towel for himself, though it did more to emphasize his physique than to hide it. The kid was ripped.
Thank you, Irwin, she said.
He grunted. Physically, he'd bounced back from the nearly lethal feeding like a rubber freaking ball. Maybe River Shoulder's water-smoothing spell had done something to help that. Mentally, he was slowly refocusing. You could see the gleam coming back into his eyes. Until that happened, he'd listened to Connie. The guy could do worse. Connie shook her head.
I remember all of it. But I have no idea what just happened.
She stared at River Shoulders for a moment, her expression more curious than fearful.
You stopped something bad from happening, I think.
Yeah, he did, I confirmed. Connie nodded toward him in a grateful little motion.
Thank you. Who are you?
Irwin's dad, I said. Irwin blinked several times. He stared blankly at River Shoulders.
Hello. River rumbled.
How something that large and that powerful could sit there bleeding from dozens of wounds and somehow look sheepish was beyond me.
I am very sorry we had to meet like that. I had hoped for something quieter. Maybe with music and good food.
You can't stay, I said to River. The authorities are on the way. River made a rumbling sound of agreement.
This is a disaster. What I did
He shook his head.
This was in such awful taste.
Couldn't have happened to nicer guys, though, I said.
Wait, Connie said. Wait. What the hell just happened here?
Irwin put a hand on her shoulder and said to me,
She's a vampire, isn't she?
I blinked and nodded at him.
How did...
Paranet, he said.
There's a whole page.
Wait, Connie said again. What? Am I going to sparkle or something?
God, no, said Irwin and I together.
Connie, I said, and she looked at me. You're still exactly who you were this morning. And so's Irwin. And that's what counts. But right now, things are going to get really complicated if the cops walk in and start asking you questions. Better if they just never knew you were here.
This is all so...
She shook her head. Then she stared at River Shoulders. Then at me.
Who are you?
I pointed at me and said,
Wizard.
I pointed at River.
Bigfoot.
I pointed at Irwin.
Son of Bigfoot.
I pointed at her.
Vampire.
Seriously.
Oh,
she said faintly.
I'll explain it,
Irwin told her quietly. He was watching River Shoulders. River held out his huge hands to either side and shrugged.
Hello, son.
Irwin shook his head slowly.
I never really...
He sucked in a deep breath, squared off against his father, and said,
Why?
And there it was. What had to be the big question of Irwin's life.
My people,
he said.
Tradition is very important to them. If I acknowledged you, they would have insisted that certain traditions be observed. It would have consumed your life. And I didn't want that for you. I didn't want that for your mother. I wanted your world to be wider than mine.
Bigfoot Irwin was silent for a long moment. Then he scratched at his head with one hand and shrugged.
Tonight really explains a lot.
He nodded slowly.
Okay. We aren't done talking, but... Okay.
Let's get you out of here, River said. Get you both taken care of. Answer all your questions.
What about Harry?
Irwin said. I couldn't get any more involved with the evident abduction of a scion of the White Court. River's mercy had probably kept the situation from going completely to hell, but I wasn't going to drag the White Council's baggage into the situation.
You guys go on, I told them.
I do this kind of thing all the time. I'll be fine.
Wow, seriously?
Irwin asked. Yeah, I said. I've been in messier situations than this. And it's probably better if Connie's dad has time to cool off before you guys talk again. River Shoulders can make sure you have that time. Outside, a cart with flashing bulbs on it had pulled up.
River,
I said.
Time's up.
River Shoulders rose and nodded deeply to me.
I'm sorry that I interfered. It seemed necessary.
I'm willing to overlook it, I said, all things considered. His face twisted into a very human-looking smile, and he extended his hand to Irwin.
son.
Erwin took his father's hand, one arm still around Connie, and the three of them didn't vanish so much as just become less and less relevant to the situation. It happened over the course of 2 or 3 seconds, as that same nebulous, somehow transparent power that River had used earlier enfolded them. And then they were all gone. Boots crunched down the hall, and a uniformed officer with the name tag reading Dean burst in, one hand on his gun. Dean eyed me, then said,
"That's all you know, huh?"
"That's the truth," I said. "I told you that you wouldn't believe it. You're gonna let me go now?"
"Oh, hell no," Dean said. "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. You're stoned out of your mind or insane. Either way, I'm gonna put you in the drunk tank until you have a chance to sleep it off."
"You got any aspirin?" I asked.
"Sure," he said, and got up to get it.
My head ached horribly, and I was pretty sure I hadn't heard the end of this, but I was clear for now. "Next time, Dresden," I muttered to myself, "just take the gold." Then Officer Dean put me in a nice quiet cell with a nice quiet cot, and there I stayed until Wild Bill Myers showed up the next morning and bailed me out.